This deep dive is brought to you by Surf Fuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at surffuel.com.
Yeah, it really is it's a phenomenal tool for getting your mind into the rhythm of the actual exam.
Exactly. Okay, so before we start, I have to ask, are you paying attention? Because today is all about the rules of the game. If you don't know your customer, you really can't recommend a single thing.
Right, you're flying blind.
Right. So let's dive in. Imagine you've spent months studying, you finally pass your Series 7, you get hired at a top firm, and then within your first year, you completely lose your license. You're hit with a $50,000 fine, and your career is just over.
Oh, man.
Why? Mm-hmm. Because you took a simple stock order from a husband who was calling about his wife's account. I mean, today, we are diving into the strict, unforgiving regulatory walls of the customer investment profile and suitability rules.
Yeah, and that is the reality of this industry. The entire regulatory framework, everything FINRA and the SEC do, it's all built on one foundational concept.
Right here.
Know your customer or the KYC rule. I mean, it is the absolute bedrock. You cannot build a house without a foundation.
Right.
And you cannot legally make a single financial recommendation without gathering the essential facts about who you are actually talking to.
Which makes total sense. We can't recommend a financial product until we know a person's financial context, you know. Hmm. But the exam isn't just going to ask for a dictionary definition.
No, definitely not.
They're going to test how these rules apply in like messy real world situations. So picture this. You're sitting at your desk. The market is having a wildly volatile day, and your phone rings. You pick it up, and it's one of your clients. Let's call him Frantic Frank.
Oh, we all have a Frantic Frank in our book of business.
Right. So Frank is just hyperventilating into the receiver. He's convinced the entire tech sector is going to completely collapse by Tuesday because of some doom and gloom blog post he just read on the internet.
Naturally.
And he wants you to liquidate his wife's entire portfolio right this second. Go straight to cash. He says he has a hunch, and he needs you to act immediately.
Okay, this is a massive, incredibly common exam trap flag. Listeners, the exam writers are going to try to trick you into thinking that marriage equals trading authority.
Oh, yeah.
It absolutely does not.
But wait, let's unpack this and argue it from Frank's perspective. I mean, they live in the same house. They probably file joint tax returns. They share a checking account. It's his money too, isn't it? Why can't I just execute the trade and save him the stress?
Because that is how people think in the emotional real world. But that is not how the regulatory wall works at all.
Okay, so what's the actual rule?
Well, account ownership is a strict legal barrier. A spouse does not have implicit authority over an individual account just because there is a marriage certificate.
So a ring on the finger means literally nothing to FINRA?
Nothing. The Know Your Customer rule demands that you understand the legal relationship context of the account. So to take an order from anyone other than the named account owner, you need documented written authorization.
Like a power of attorney.
Exactly. And it has to be on file before the trade happens, not after before.
Right.
So a limited power of attorney that allows them to execute trades, while a full power of attorney allows them to trade and also withdraw money.
Oh, so there are levels to it.
Yeah. But if Frank's wife hasn't signed that specific paperwork and physically filed it with your firm, Frank is legally a complete stranger to that account.
So no paperwork, no trades. I literally have to tell a screaming Frank, sorry, I cannot confirm or deny anything about this account, and I need to speak to your wife.
Yes, you have to hold that boundary, because if you execute that trade just to appease him and get him off the phone, you are conducting unauthorized trading.
Which is bad.
It's a severe violation. The SEC and FINRA, they don't care if the trade actually ended up saving them money. You broke the procedural law. Before you act on any instruction, you must establish the legal authority of the person giving it.
All right. So pop quiz for everyone listening right now. Mm-hmm. What do you do if Frank calls to sell his wife's stock, but he swears he'll email you the power of attorney form right after the market closes? Let's give it a beat to think.
Yeah. What's the answer?
The answer is nothing. You do absolutely nothing until that written document is literally in your firm's possession.
Precisely. And this extends to major life events as well. If the account owner calls to update their profile, you confirm those material changes directly with them, not a third party.
Okay, so let's say Frank calms down. He puts his wife on the phone. She handles her own account. And now Frank wants to look at his own personal account. We have his legal identity, sure. But now we have to figure out what he actually wants his money to do, his investment objectives.
Right.
From the sources, I see this basically operates on a spectrum of risk.
It does, yeah. The industry generally breaks objectives down into four primary categories, kind of on a sliding scale.
Okay, walk me through them.
So at the lowest risk end, you have preservation of capital. This is all about ultimate safety. The client literally cannot afford to lose the principal.
So if they check this box, what kind of products are we talking about?
You're looking at things like money market funds, bank certificates of deposit, or short-term treasury bills.
Safe, but barely beating inflation, right?
Exactly. You're just parking the money. Then second is current income.
Okay.
This client wants regular, predictable cash flow generated by their portfolio. They aren't trying to get rich quick. They just want a steady check to live on.
Right, like retirees usually. So what fits there?
You're looking at investment-grade corporate bonds, municipal bonds, or maybe stable, dividend-paying blue-chip stocks.
Okay, so that's the conservative side of things. What about the aggressive side?
Third is growth. This is seeking capital appreciation over a longer time horizon. You know, you are willing to accept market volatility because you want the underlying asset to increase in value over time.
So you're not pulling out the cash, you just want the pile to get bigger.
Right, which usually points to a diversified portfolio of equities, like large cap or mid cap mutual funds.
Okay, and the last one.
Finally, at the far end of the risk spectrum, you have speculation.
Maximum risk for maximum return.
Exactly. This client is actively trying to beat the market and is entirely willing to lose their entire principal to do it.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. This opens the door to high-yield junk bonds, options trading, penny stocks, and leveraged ETFs.
Okay. So back to Frantic Frank.
Yeah.
He is 65 years old. He just retired. Mm-hmm. And we look at his financial profile. He has very little saved in the bank. He absolutely needs this portfolio to pay for his groceries.
Right.
But when he fills out his new account form, he checks the objective box for speculation.
Oh.
Yeah. He wants to trade leveraged options. Let me ask you listening right now. So what do you do when a client's profile screams preservation, but they check the box for speculation? Do you just casually cross it out and fix it for him?
Think about it for a second.
No. But wait, why not? If I am the financial professional and I know for a fact it's a mathematically terrible idea that will ruin his retirement, why can't I just override the form and protect him from himself?
It's a great philosophical question, honestly, but if we connect this to the regulatory reality, the overriding rule is that it is ultimately the customer's money.
Right.
When a customer's stated objective dramatically conflicts with their financial profile, that mismatch is a giant red flag. But the correct action on the exam is never, ever to unilaterally alter the document.
I see.
You are a fiduciary in many respects, but you're not their parent.
Okay, so what's the actual required action then?
You must halt the process, discuss the inconsistency with the client directly, and document that conversation thoroughly. It's basically a CYA move, cover your assets.
I love that, cover your assets. So I have to sit Frank down and say, Frank, you are 65. Your profile says you need this money for basic living expenses, but speculation means you could lose it all by Friday. Are you absolutely sure this is your objective?
Yes, exactly that. And if he insists, you document that you provided that warning, and you let the firm's compliance department decide if they want to accept the account.
So the firm might just say, no thanks.
Yeah, compliance might just reject the account entirely because the liability is too high. But you never, ever change a customer's profile without their explicit written consent.
Because that documentation is your shield when Frank loses all his money and tries to sue you 2 years later.
Exactly. And remember, the investment profile is not a static one-time snapshot that you just file away and forget about.
It's not.
No, it's a living, breathing document. Any major life event is a trigger to reassess everything. If Frank suddenly receives a massive inheritance, or if he gets divorced, or if he goes back to work, his profile changes.
Right, because his financial context shifted.
Right. What was highly suitable for him yesterday might be completely unsuitable today.
Which brings us to, honestly, the most critical life event you will ever look at on a customer's profile. Their income jumping into a higher tax bracket.
Oh, absolutely.
Because once they hit those top tiers, the math changes completely. Taxable corporate bonds stop making sense, and we have to start looking at a very specific type of product.
Municipal bonds. If you are taking the Series 7, you just need to accept that the exam writers have an absolute obsession with municipal bonds.
They really do, because they have a superpower, right? Specifically, federal tax exception.
Yep.
So let's bring in a new character to illustrate this. Tax-averse Tom.
I like Tom already.
We all know a Tom. Tom hates paying taxes so much that he refuses to drive on public toll roads.
Ooh.
He will take a three-hour muddy detour on back roads just to avoid giving the local government $2.
That is dedication.
Naturally, Tom loves municipal bonds because the interest they pay is generally exempt from federal income tax.
He does. But before we get to Tom's personal portfolio, we need to flag a massive suitability trap regarding municipal bonds.
Okay, lay on us.
So the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, they write the rules for this space, and they dictate that you must know a customer's exact tax status before recommending a muni. Recommending a municipal bond to a tax-exempt entity is one of the most classic suitability violations on the entire exam.
Wait, a tax-exempt entity, like a nonprofit charity or a pension fund?
Exactly. Let's say you manage a massive corporate pension fund. The pension fund does not pay taxes on its investment gains.
So if I sell them a municipal bond, they get tax-free income. What's the problem?
The problem is the opportunity cost. The entire value proposition of a municipal bond is its tax exemption. Because the government is offering you tax-free money, they pay a significantly lower stated yield than a comparable corporate bond.
Ah.
So if a corporate bond pays 7%, a muni might only pay 5%. If you recommend that 5% muni to a pension fund, you are forcing them to accept a lower yield for a tax break they literally cannot use.
Because they already don't pay taxes.
Exactly. You just threw away 2% of yield for nothing. It's a terrible, unsuitable recommendation.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Keep munis away from tax-exempt accounts. But tax-averse Tom is an individual. He is a high earner. He's in the highest federal tax bracket. So munis make a lot of sense for him.
They do.
But how do we actually prove that to Tom?
Uh-huh.
Because on the exam, they're going to give you a scenario where Tom has to choose between a muni bond paying 5% and a corporate bond paying 7%. How do we actually do the math?
Well, you cannot just eyeball the raw percentages. 5% versus 7% is an illusion. Until you factor in the IRS, you have to use direct comparison math to put them on an equal playing field.
Right.
And there are two formulas you can use, and they both get you to the exact same decision. The first is finding the tax equivalent yield of the muni.
Walk me through the mechanics of that. How do I find it?
Okay. You take the municipal bond yield and you divide it by the result of 1 minus the customer's tax rate.
Okay. So if the muni pays 5%, and Tom is in the 30% tax bracket.
You do 1 minus 0.30, which is 0.70. Then you divide 5 by 0.70, and you get 7.14%.
Okay, so what does that 7.14% actually mean in plain English for Tom?
It means that for Tom to get the exact same amount of cash in his pocket after taxes, he would have to find a corporate bond paying 7.14%.
Oh, wow.
Since the corporate bond he's looking at only pays 7%, the 5% muni is actually the better deal for him.
That's the tax equivalent yield. What's the second formula?
The after-tax yield of the corporate bond. This one is often easier for people to calculate quickly on the test. You take the corporate yield and multiply it by 1 minus the tax rate.
Okay, so 7% multiplied by 0.70 equals 4.9%.
Exactly.
So the corporate bond only gives Tom 4.9% after the IRS takes their cut, but the muni gives him a clean 5%, so the muni wins again.
Yep, math checks out.
You know, I like to use an analogy for this because raw yields are just so deceptive. It's exactly like comparing the price of a flight on an ultra-budget airline versus a premium airline.
Oh, I hate budget airlines.
Right. So the budget ticket says $50. The premium ticket says $100. If you just look at the raw numbers, you buy the budget ticket, but then you get to the airport and the budget airline charges $60 for a carry-on bag.
Right. The hidden cost.
Exactly. You have to factor in the baggage fees, which in our case are the income taxes, to see which flight is actually cheaper. You have to put both bonds on an after-tax basis before you can tell which one actually puts more money in Tom's pocket at the end of the day.
That is a perfect analogy, and the higher the customer's tax bracket, the higher those baggage fees are on the corporate bond, which makes the municipal bond's tax exemption incredibly valuable.
Wait, Tom thinks he's a financial genius now. He comes to you and says, I love this shiny tax-free municipal bond so much,
yeah.
I am going to buy it and I'm going to put it inside my traditional IRA. Pop quiz time again. Does this make sense for Tom? Just think about it.
Yeah, does it?
It is an absolute disaster.
It really is.
But wait, push back with me for a second. An IRA is a retirement account.
Mm-hmm.
It's meant for safety. Municipal bonds are incredibly safe. Why wouldn't I combine them? It sounds like a match made in heaven.
Well, you have to think about the mechanics of the tax wrappers. Putting a tax-exempt municipal bond inside a tax-deferred IRA is like wearing a raincoat while you are already standing inside a waterproof submarine.
The raincoat in a submarine, I love that so much. It's completely redundant.
Exactly. You are completely wasting the bond's superpower. The IRA wrapper already shelters everything inside it from taxes until you withdraw the money.
Right.
So if you put a low-yielding muni inside it, you are accepting a local return to get a tax break that the account wrapper is already providing for free.
You just caused Tom yield for absolutely no reason.
Exactly. This is a classic suitability red flag. The rule of thumb for the exam. Put your high-yielding, heavily taxed corporate bonds inside the IRA submarine and keep your tax-free munis out in the rain in a regular taxable brokerage account.
That visual is never leaving my brain. The raincoat in the submarine. Okay, before we leave Taxiverse, Tom, let's touch on state taxes. What is this double tax-free thing Tom was asking about?
Right, so that comes down to where the bond is actually issued. If you buy a municipal bond issued by your home state, the interest is generally exempt from federal tax ND, your state's income tax.
Oh, that's the double exemption.
Yeah. But if you live in New York and buy a bond issued by California, you get the federal exemption, but New York will usually tax that interest at the state level.
Okay, so logically, Tom should always buy bonds from his home state. But what if Tom finally gets fed up with taxes entirely and moves to Texas or Florida, where there is no state income tax at all?
What's fascinating here is that the in-state advantage completely vanishes.
Wait, really?
Yeah. In a no-income tax state, every single municipal bond in the country is treated exactly the same at the state level, which is to say, they aren't taxed at all because the state doesn't have an income tax.
Oh, I see.
So if Tom lives in Texas, he shouldn't artificially limit himself to Texas munis. He should just scan the entire national market and chase the highest yielding muni available anywhere because the state tax consequence is zero across the board.
That's a brilliant nuance, and that is definitely going to be tested. All right, let's shift gears. Hey, are you still walking? Still staring at your flashcards? Shake it out, reset your brain, because this next section is guaranteed to be on your exam.
Guaranteed.
We spent time looking at average Joes like Frank and Tom, but what happens when we start dealing with the ultra rich? We've all seen the headlines about crazy private equity deals, venture capital, and complex hedge funds. Why can't Frank and Tom buy those?
Because they don't have the money.
Right, but does having money automatically mean you have financial intelligence?
The SEC firmly believes there is a massive difference between wealth and intelligence. And that distinction is the entire core of the accredited versus sophisticated investor rules.
Let's bring in our third character, Wealthy Wendy.
Oh, Wealthy Wendy.
Wendy just inherited $2 million from her grandfather. She also makes $400,000 a year as a highly paid influencer.
Huh.
But Wendy thinks asset allocation means deciding which marina in Miami she is going to park her yacht in.
Okay, so we have to evaluate Wendy using two completely different, distinct standards before we can sell her anything complex.
Okay.
Let's start with accreditation under Regulation D, which is the regulatory gateway for private placements. There is a very testable memory aid for this, the 1-2-3 rule.
Walk us through the 1-2-3 rule thresholds.
Okay. One stands for $1 million in net worth. But crucially, you must exclude the value of their primary residence.
Okay, keep going.
Two stands for $200,000 in individual annual income for the last 2 years with the expectation of hitting it again this current year.
And the three.
And three stands for $300,000 in joint income with a spouse for the last 2 years. If Wendy hits just one of those three thresholds, she is officially an accredited investor.
Well, since Wendy inherited $2 million and makes $400K individually, she easily passes. She's accredited. But let's dig into that primary residence exclusion. Why does the SEC care about her house? Why exclude it from her net worth?
Because the SEC is trying to measure liquid investment capital, not the roof over your head. If a private placement goes to zero, they don't want you losing your home.
That makes sense.
And this brings up a very specific, sneaky exam trap flag, the 60-day home equity rule.
Oh, how does this loophole work?
Well, think about the psychology of a greedy investor. The SEC knows that if someone has, say, $800,000 in the bank, just shy of the $1 million net worth mark, they might try to cheat the system to get into a hot private deal.
How would they do that?
They might go to the bank, take out a massive $300,000 home equity loan against their excluded house, and dump that cash into their checking account to artificially inflate their liquid net worth to $1.1 million right before they sign the paperwork.
Wow. So they leverage the excluded asset to fake the liquid asset.
Exactly. To stop this, the rule says any new debt secured by your primary residence taken out in the 60 days prior to the investment counts as a liability against your network.
Oh, bam. Loophole closed.
Yep. So that $300,000 loan wipes out the cash and they fail the test.
Okay, so Wendy has the $2 million in cash, no loans. She is definitely accredited. She's got the money. Now, let's talk about the second standard, sophistication.
Right. So if accreditation is an objective mathematical test about financial capacity, sophistication is a subjective knowledge-based test.
Okay.
It evaluates the investor's actual demonstrated ability to understand the merits and the deep risks of a complex investment.
How does a broker actually prove that? It's not just a mathematical formula. Do you make them take a quiz or something?
In practice, yes. It involves extensive risk disclosure questionnaires, but it's also about documenting their background.
Like their resume.
Exactly. The broker has to gather evidence. What is their educational background? Do they have advanced degrees in finance? What is their professional background? Are they a CFO? And most importantly, what is their actual trading experience? Have they successfully traded complex options for 10 years, or did they just inherit this money yesterday?
Which brings us back to Wendy. Wendy thinks asset allocation is about both. She inherited the money yesterday. So Wendy is mathematically accredited, but she is not sophisticated.
Definitely not.
But here's my question. If she has millions of dollars to burn and she explicitly wants to buy a crazy, illiquid hedge fund, can I just sell it to her anyway?
This raises an incredibly important question, and it's one the exam loves to test to see if you understand the underlying philosophy of the law. The answer is absolutely not.
Wait, really?
Yes. Accreditation opens the door to eligibility. It simply means you are legally allowed to offer her a private placement under Reg JD without registering it with the SEC. But eligibility does not equal suitability.
Say that again, because that is a golden rule. Eligibility does not equal suitability.
They are two entirely different keys, and you need both keys to open the door to complex products. Wendy has the first key, the money. But she lacks the second key, the sophistication to evaluate a hedge fund.
Nor does it fit her goals if she needs immediate liquidity for yacht maintenance.
Right. Even if she has $50 million, if the product conflicts with her risk tolerance, her time horizon, or her knowledge base, it is unsuitable, period. You cannot sell it to her.
Okay, so we've established who our customers are. We know their tax brackets. We know if they are accredited. We know if they are sophisticated. We have all the data.
Yep.
But what does this all mean in practice? What exact legal framework holds our feet to the fire when we finally open our mouths to make a recommendation?
Historically, the overarching framework has been the Fed and RA suitability rule. And it still is for many situations. Fed and RA break suitability down into three distinct progressive buckets, and you have to pass all three to make a legal recommendation.
Okay, let's logic this out. Before I even look at Frank or Wendy, the regulators must have some sort of baseline test for the product itself. Right? Like the investment can't just be a total scam.
Exactly. That is bucket number one, reasonable basis suitability.
Okay.
This is entirely about the product, not the customer. It asks two questions. Do I, the broker, actually understand the mechanics of this product? And is it a reasonable investment for at least some people in the world?
So if I'm selling a complex collateralized debt obligation, and I don't actually understand how it works, I can't recommend it, even if it happens to go up in value.
Precisely. If you don't understand it, you violate reasonable basis suitability. Now, once the product clears that hurdle, we move to bucket number two.
Which I'm guessing is the matchmaker bucket. Now we bring the customer into it.
Right. Customer-specific suitability. Is this product right for this specific customer based on their unique profile?
Okay, give me an example.
A highly leveraged ETF might be a perfectly reasonable product under bucket one for a sophisticated day trader, but it is a massive violation of bucket two if you recommend it to Frantic Frank, who needs to preserve his capital.
Makes perfect sense. So bucket one is the product, bucket two is the match. What is bucket three?
Quantitative suitability. And this one is fascinating because it looks at the overall pattern of trading in the account rather than a single trade.
Wait, a pattern?
Yeah. Even if every single individual trade you make is highly suitable for the client, is the sheer volume of trading excessive?
How do regulators even measure that? What is excessive?
They look at the math, they look at turnover rates, and the cost equity ratio.
Explain those mechanics to me.
Sure. Turnover rate is how many times the total value of the account is replaced during a year. If a client has $100,000 and you buy and sell $600,000 worth of securities over 12 months, that's a 6x turnover rate.
Wow, that's a lot of trading.
It is. Historically, regulators start looking very closely at anything over a 6x turnover.
And what about the cost equity ratio?
That measures how much the account has to earn just to cover your commission fees.
Oh, I see.
If the cost equity ratio is 20%, that means the client's portfolio has to generate a 20% return just to break even. Regulators look at that math and instantly know you are violating quantitative suitability.
Exam trap flag right here. The exam is going to try to get you to confuse two terms, excessive trading and churning. They sound like the exact same thing. What is the actual difference?
It comes down to intent, which is a massive distinction in the eyes of the law. Excessive trading is simply the regulatory violation we just talked about under quantitative suitability.
The bad math.
Right. The math shows the turnover is too high or the cost equity ratio is unmanageable. You broke the rule. It doesn't matter if you meant well or if you were just overly excited about the market. You are strictly liable for the bad math.
And churning.
Churning is a severe fraud claim. It requires scienter, which is a legal term for evil intent.
Scienter. Good word.
Yeah, churning means you intentionally overtraded the account specifically to generate commissions to enrich yourself with total disregard for the client's well-being. It is a deliberate act of fraud.
So excessive trading is doing bad math and failing to monitor the account. Churning is being an intentional villain.
Exactly.
But wait, I know FINRA suitability is kind of the old news for regular folks, right? Because the SEC recently rolled out a massive upgrade to this entire system.
Yes, they did. Regulation Best Interest, commonly known as Reg BI.
Who does Reg BI actually apply to? Do I use it for Wendy or for the pension fund?
It applies exclusively to retail customers. So Frantic Frank, Tax-Averse Tom, and Wealthy Wendy, because they are human beings using this money for personal or family purposes, they are all protected by Reg BI.
Got it.
FINRA suitability, the three buckets we just discussed, still remains the standard for institutional customers, like our tax-exempt pension fund or a massive bank.
Okay, so Reg BI for retail human beings. FINRA suitability for institutions. What makes Reg BI so different? It's built on four core components, right?
Yes. Disclosure, care, conflict of interest, and compliance. And here is a quick memory trick for the exam.
Let's hear it.
Disclosure, conflict of interest, and compliance all explicitly require you to create written documents or written policies.
Okay.
The care obligation is the only one of the four that doesn't require a specific new written document. It's about the standard of diligence, skill, and analysis you apply to the recommendation.
Let's dig into the why here. Why did the SEC spend years creating Reg BI? What was so fundamentally broken with the old suitability rule that they had to rewrite the playbook for retail investors?
It came down to hidden costs and misaligned incentives. Under the old FINRA suitability standard, let's say you have two mutual funds that are virtually identical in their underlying stocks. Fund A charges the client a 1% management fee. Fund B charges the client a 2% fee, but Fund B pays the broker a much higher commission for selling it.
I see where this is going.
Under the old suitability rules, the broker could legally recommend Fund B.
Wait, legally?
Yes. It was technically suitable for the client's growth goals, even though it cost the client more money, simply because the broker wanted the higher commission. The broker wasn't technically violating suitability, but they clearly weren't acting in the client's best interest.
Oh, that's incredibly messed up. The client is bleeding fees just to buy the broker a nicer car.
The SEC completely agreed. So under Reg BI's care obligation, they introduced a massive new requirement, cost comparison.
Okay, how does that work?
You are now legally required to consider the costs among reasonably available alternatives. You cannot put your firm's financial interests ahead of the retail customer's interests. Given the choice between those two identical funds, Reg BI forces you to recommend the cheaper Fund A.
That is a huge, highly testable upgrade for retail investors. What about the conflict of interest obligation? Wall Street runs on money. Can a broker-dealer have conflicts of interest at all under Reg BI?
Yes, because it's impossible to eliminate every conflict in a commission-based business. But Reg BI draws a very strict, bright line between conflicts you can mitigate and conflicts you must entirely eliminate.
Give me an example of a conflict that the SEC says you can just mitigate.
Broad revenue sharing agreements. Let's say a specific mutual fund family pays your brokerage firm a little extra money to be placed on your firm's preferred product list.
Okay.
That is obviously a massive conflict of interest, but the SEC says you can keep doing it as long as you explicitly identify it, fully disclose it in writing to the retail customer so they know about the financial arrangement, and mitigate it with strong supervisory controls so it doesn't distort your broker's advice.
Okay, so broad corporate relationships can be disclosed. What is an example of something that is so toxic it must be absolutely eliminated?
Targeted, time-limited sales contests for specific securities. If the firm management sends out an email saying, whoever sells the most shares of XYZ tech stock by Friday wins an all-expenses-paid trip to Hawaii, Reg BI says that practice must be eliminated immediately.
Because it completely destroys objectivity.
Exactly. Disclosure doesn't fix it. You can't just tell the client, hey, I'm recommending this stock because I really want to go to Maui.
Yeah, that wouldn't go over well.
Right. You cannot cure that kind of targeted security-specific incentive because the broker is no longer looking at the customer's profile. They're only looking at the prize. It must be eliminated.
Here's where it gets really interesting. So Reg BI and suitability are serious career-ending business if you get them wrong.
Mm.
But they are only triggered when the broker actually makes a recommendation.
Correct.
If I'm just an order taker, if I just sit there and don't offer any advice, I don't trigger the rules, right?
That's correct. An unsolicited trade, meaning a trade purely initiated by the customer without any prompting or nudging from you, does not trigger suitability or Reg BI.
But let's explore the gray areas, because I know the exam loves the gray areas. What if a client is panicking about the market? They call me, they ask what they should do with their current portfolio, and I tell them to just do absolutely nothing. Just hold the line. I didn't tell them to buy. I didn't tell them to sell. I told them to do nothing.
This is a critical distinction. Telling someone to do nothing is an explicit hold recommendation.
Wait, really?
Yes. And if you say yes, holding your XYZ stock fits your profile, bam, you just crossed the line. You made a regulated recommendation. An explicit hold triggers the exact same suitability and Reg BI requirements as telling them to buy or sell.
Wow. Because giving professional advice to stay on a sinking ship is still giving financial advice. You are affirming that the current portfolio is suitable.
Exactly. You are taking responsibility for that strategy. However, if you are doing a routine annual review of their account, you discuss their life goals, and you stay completely silent about their current specific holdings, that's an implicit hold.
Okay, so silence is safe.
Right. Suitability is not triggered by silence. You have to explicitly advise them to hold the security.
Okay, what about asset allocation? If I'm trying to be helpful and I tell a new client, look, at your age, you should really maintain a standard 60-40 mix of stocks and bonds. Is that generic advice a recommendation that triggers all this regulatory paperwork?
No, actually, there is a specific safe harbor for generic asset allocation. If you just discuss broad asset classes, saying maintain a 60-40 mix of equities and fixed income, you are safe. It's considered educational.
But what if I try to be too helpful? What if I say, keep your 60-40 mix, and you should execute it using this specific Vanguard S&P 500 fund and this specific iShares bond ETF.
The second you name a specific security, the safe harbor instantly vanishes and full Reg BI and suitability rules apply. It's all about moving from generic education to a specific actionable security recommendation.
Okay, final gray area, technology.
Oh yeah.
Brokerages love their fancy software platforms. If I have a client in my office and I pull up a beautiful Monte Carlo simulation charting out their retirement, projecting that they'll have $3 million by age 60, am I allowed to show them that? Because aren't we forbidden from guaranteeing returns?
Generally, broker-dealers are strictly prohibited from showing hypothetical projections of performance. You cannot promise the future. But there is a narrow, heavily regulated exception for what Finera calls investment analysis tools.
What's the catch to use the tool legally?
The tool must be highly interactive. The customer has to be able to input their own specific data, their own age, their own savings rate, their own risk tolerance, and see individualized varying simulations based on different market conditions. And it must be a one-on-one process.
Pop quiz for the listener on this one. They love testing the disclaimer for these tools on the exam. The rule says the disclaimer has to be clear and prominent. What does that actually mean in the digital age? Does it mean giant, bold font? Take a second to think.
Yeah, is it just about size?
No, it doesn't require a special neon font. Clear and prominent is about accessibility and user interface.
Exactly. The disclaimer, which must state that the results are hypothetical and not guarantees of future results, must stay readable on the screen right next to the projection. If it's a pop-up window that auto-dismisses after 5 seconds, or if the client has to scroll down 4 pages to find it, it fails the clear and prominent test.
Okay, so it has to live on the screen next to the math. What if I bypass the software entirely? What if I print out a beautiful PDF brochure with a static hypothetical chart showing a 10% return, and I hand it out to 100 prospective clients at a retirement seminar?
That is an automatic violation.
Instant fail.
Yep. A static PDF is not interactive, so it's not an analysis tool. And a marketing presentation given to a group of 100 people is not a one-on-one process. Those static projections never qualify under the analysis tool rule, no matter how perfectly worded the legal disclaimer at the bottom is.
Man, the regulatory walls are incredibly tight. You really have to know the mechanics of these rules to survive in this industry.
You really do.
All right, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Let's bring it all home for exam day. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways.
Let's do it.
I'll start us off. Number one, spouses need written authority to trade. A marriage certificate does not equal a power of attorney. If Frank calls to sell his wife's stock, you do nothing until the paperwork is filed.
Number two, don't override a mismatched objective. If Frank's financial reality demands preservation, but he wants to speculate with his grocery money, you discuss it and document the warning. You never change his profile unilaterally.
Number three, use after-tax yield to compare muties to corporates. Don't look at the raw percentages. Factor in the baggage fees, the taxes. Multiply the corporate yield by one minus the tax rate to see which bond actually wins.
Number four, never put a tax-free muni inside a tax-deferred IRA. It's wearing a raincoat inside a submarine. You are wasting the bond's tax benefit and costing the client yield.
Number five, accredited versus sophisticated. Accredited means you hit the math, like Wendy's $1 net worth or $200K income, excluding her house. Sophisticated means you have the documented brains and experience to understand the risk. Remember, eligibility does not equal suitability.
Number six, Red BI is the new standard for retail customers and legally requires you to compare costs to find the best option. Fine and raw suitability remains for institutional customers.
And finally, number seven, explicitly telling someone to hold their stock is a regulated recommendation. Giving advice to stay on the ship is still financial advice.
Excellent recap. I want to leave everyone listening with a final thought to mull over as they study. Think about how rapidly advancing technology is blurring the very lines we just defined.
Well, where do you see the collision happening?
Think about robo-advisors and AI. If an AI algorithm built by a broker-dealer automatically nudges a retail investor's phone with a push alert saying, "Markets are volatile today. Consider holding your tech stocks," is that push alert an explicit hold recommendation?
Well,
is a piece of code acting as a fiduciary under Reg BI's care obligation? Does the algorithm have to document a cost comparison? The laws we just learned were written for humans talking to humans on telephones. But the future of suitability is going to be regulators trying to apply these exact same rules to machines.
That is wild to think about. An algorithm violating Reg BI and getting fined by the SEC because its code didn't mitigate a conflict of interest.
It's coming.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into the regulatory gauntlet of suitability and customer profiles. Keep studying, trust your preparation, remember the raincoat and the submarine, and we will see you next time.